Hi, and welcome back to The Growth System, the podcast which looks at B2B growth through a systems thinking lens. And today we're carrying on with our series where we explore the dimensions of the growth team operating system, moving on to that kind of last segment, the execution segment today with authority, by which we essentially mean sort of how we share power and make decisions, sort of who's empowered to decide what, and I guess how decisions get made. Now, Chris, I think this is another topic, I think, that gets us back to a problem that we had in the structure episode, where people tend to think about authority as in terms of org charts and command structures. But maybe you could sort of set the scene by giving it a sort of deeper systems thinking take on that, as always.
Yeah, I think authority is such an interesting topic, because it always feels quite binary, quite role-based. You know, why are we talking about authority? Sort of everyone knows, you know, where they're supposed to be and what they're supposed to be doing, surely. But the reality, and I think probably most people's lived experience will map to this, or at least I would hope so, is not quite as simple. And when we view it through a systems lens, then, you know, you've got some quite interesting stuff here. So without wishing to kind of go super geeky right out the traps, I think I'm going to probably struggle to avoid that. There is in systems something called the viable system model. So it is linked to cybernetics. It is developed by a guy called Stafford Beer, who is, I think a very famous systems thinker. And he talks about kind of the viable system model has five subsystems in it, and they govern things like operations and coordination and intelligence and policy and sort of how we kind of manage kind of identity within an org or within a system. And when we kind of apply that and sort of view that through the lens of authority, then we need to think about stuff like how distributed control, authority in effect, helps us govern the way that systems are managed. So in the viable system model, you would suggest that authority doesn't, as we were just talking about, sit in a kind of single top node. Authority and control is dispersed across the whole system. And therefore, when we're talking about how we manage that, it's really about how we think about degrees of autonomy, how we kind of link the authority to goals in a way. So actually, you know, how are the parts of the subsystem, how is the sort of distributed control acting on behalf of the whole system? How we sort of balance, I guess, freedom to decide with the policy that's kind of set at sort of a super system level, at a higher level, at a management level, if we want to kind of bring that right back into the organization. And a lot of that, as we always talk about in systems, is governed by feedback loops. So feedback mechanisms within the organization carry information around fundamentally. And what, when we think about, again, through that sort of systems lens and authority, then feedback loops ultimately help managers and employees, contributors within the organization at different levels to kind of share insight and adjust decisions and ultimately put real-time data into that. And you can already kind of see within this kind of systems view, what we've got is authority flowing through the organization. We've got a kind of distribution of control. We've got a relationship to purpose. And we've also got the kind of, variable balance that is created by those sort of, by sort of system feedback. And what I mean by that is information is obviously a significant part of decision-making. You know, we don't want to make decisions without having information. Feedback loops in themselves are information. So how we kind of collect that and how we manage that kind of through the org has an impact on who has the ability to make decisions, not just the authority to make decisions. So that kind of authority and its sort of second cousin, the decision-making process, is has a huge impact on system behavior. And when we think about it in the context of the sort of growth system design model, and you know, the growth team OS that we've been talking about in this series, it's deeply interlinked with lots of the other dimensions, as you would imagine. So it's deeply linked to purpose, as we've said. It's deeply linked to strategy. You know, for a strategy to progress, strategies are, you know, multimodal, multi-channel, multifunctional. So they're full of the requirement to make little micro decisions, to listen to feedback loops, and to continue making lots and lots of decisions to keep them moving forward. And ultimately, they're in a big way linked to collaboration. You know, how do we get together to make decisions? And we'll talk a little later, I suspect, about concepts like shadow authority. You know, it might say that this person has the right to make the decision, but actually, in reality, they don't. Or the sort of, you know, the mob rule kind of reigns within, you know, within certain part of the org, and actually it's not, you know, decisions get made the way you think they will do. So there is a huge impact of authority on system performance and system behavior, and I guess we'll dig into that as we go.
Something that keeps coming up across this series and indeed the previous series is this sort of tension between centralization and, I guess, in this case, we would frame it as sort of distributed authority. Mm-hmm. I guess we should talk a little bit about how to manage that tension and what sort of our take on how to manage that tension is, I guess, is what I'm trying to say. Obviously, there are situations where, I guess, too much distribution of sort of an autonomy can lead to things like sort of damage to brand integrity, for example, but also over centralization, we might be sort of stifling local innovation or even just the speed of local decision making, I guess. So what advice would you give to sort of B2B companies that are sort of trying to strike that balance?
It's such a great question, because I think there's, you know, there's two things in there. There is like the, you know, where should you draw the slider on kind of centralized control, but there's also this, you know, what you sort of alluded to, the fact that authority can often be quite adaptive. And I think that, you know, there's two really interesting facets going on there. I think that most people have probably worked in an organization where there is too much centralized control, whether that is because, you know, a founder makes every decision. You know, we've had that experience before with a now ex-customer. You know, that nothing could be done without the founder saying so. And of course, the founder was a human being, so didn't actually have the, you know, the ability to understand and be part of every decision. So just decisions to get made and stuff stalled, and the whole organization grinds to a halt. So that's obviously the argument against centralization. I've been in a scenario in my kind of sort of first part of my career working in the car industry, working for a very well-known German manufacturer, where all big decisions had to be made in Germany. You know, the markets could not be allowed to, you know, to decide for themselves. Everything had to go back to the, you know, to the center to be decided upon. And it just created a stagnant organization, but it also created, and something we talked about in the last episode, I think, created workarounds, you know, created, we were talking about processes and workflows. Well, the true process was actually you had to frame the decision in a certain way so that it didn't have trigger the, you know, someone in Germany needs to look at this. So you had this, you know, again, this kind of shadow system that was existing. So centralization, I think we can probably agree is bad when it is in abundance, you know, when you have too much centralization. But equally, exactly as you said, going the other way is you know, has its pitfalls as well. So how do you strike the balance in the middle? And for me, that's a really tough one to speak about kind of unilaterally, you know, or sort of, you know, universally, perhaps I should say. It's going to be different in every organization, but I would say that one of the starting points there is really to build an organization that is agile and is adaptive, and, you know, where authority is sort of, I was about to say non-binary. That means something else these days, doesn't it? It's not a switch where you can just say, yes, you either have it or you don't, or, you know, it's quite situation. If you start shaping scenarios where in certain kind of strategic conditions or in certain scenarios, you know, you can dial up authority. In other areas, you can dial it down. And I think that that is how most small organizations work. I think it's fair to say. And I think that is a skill that is often lost as organizations become larger and become more structured. And I think that is probably the answer to kind of managing that tension, is to actually have that sort of agile decision-making mindset. And, you know, I guess you'd probably recognize it, you know, within rev space. You know, there are things that, to speak very openly, I want to have a really big control over. You know, there are things that I really want to be a part of. There are other things where I'm very, very happy for people to just get on and do it and just make decisions and, you know, spend the budget within the realms of the budget or whatever that might be. And very often that delineation between those two states has nothing to do with the job title of the person making the decision. It's really based on how I feel about things.
Yeah, there's definitely a sort of pragmatic element to how we organize that and put structures in place to enable that sort of distributed decision make or to try and strike the right balance between that sort of distribution of decision making power and authority and sort of centralization, which in the case of us means you.
Indeed. And I think that perhaps the answer to your question of, okay, well, how do you manage the tension? And I guess we're talking predominantly about, you know, mid-market and above organizations which have developed some structure. You know, they have departments, they have teams, and therefore structure is something that is perhaps more rigid than it is in an organization of sort of 20-odd people like we are. And the answer, I think, is really about feedback and utilizing feedback loops, because if you build those feedback mechanisms into the organization, then actually you partner that, I suppose, with a culture of kind of adaptive control. You know, you sort of decentralize the decision making about how adaptive you can be, you know, into team leaders or kind of departmental heads, and you build those kind of strong feedback mechanisms, then actually you can be more delegated, you can distribute control further, because you can, you know, have the data to understand how those kind of local decisions align with kind of overarching kind of system goals, system purpose, you know, the mission of the organization. And, you know, I think having that kind of agile mindset while keeping a sort of feedback-based and therefore data-based hand on, you know, when you let the lead out and when you rein it back in again, I think is probably the answer to how you manage that. But it would be difficult to write that into a process document. And I think that's why larger organizations often fail in that regard. But I do not think it's impossible to achieve that. I think it's a culture-based thing to a significant extent. I think that if you bake that into the values of the organization, then you can perhaps bake that into the mental model to some degree. You know, I think that, actually going back to another car industry example, you know, I worked for Jaguar before they kind of, well, certainly well before they did what they've done recently. But
So that's not your fault?
Is that just, no, it's not my fault. I have many opinions about it, but it's definitely not my fault. But you know, the interesting direction the brand has taken at the moment, you know, when I was working there, it was a brand that had a startup culture. You know, it still had 14,000 people in, but that was a minnow compared to, you know, the big German manufacturers that I've sort of latterly worked for before, you know, back when I had a proper job. And they had a startup culture through the organization that, despite the fact it was a very old, 100-year-old, nearly British brand, they absolutely, had a value set where people treated the business's money like it was their own. You know, they had the ability to kind of have shaped the mental model where everyone knew what they were doing. You know, we knew that, you were taking the fight to the big guys. You needed to spend money intelligently. There wasn't huge amounts of control. You had that kind of slightly agile approach. You had sort of internal competition, and you did have checks and balances, but actually they were a really good example of having strong distributed control, and that worked. The example of the manufacturer I moved to actually directly after that was a culture shock for me, because they had none of that, and I think actually in reflection, just in having this conversation, it was as much, it manifests itself as distributed authority. It manifests itself as sort of distributed control, but in reality, it was actually cultural. And I think maybe that culture and feedback is probably the answer. There we go. Got there in the end.
Yeah. That was a good example. And no surprise, it came from the car industry example. So I guess when authority sort of properly balanced, where there's sort of boundaries and structures in place, but obviously the allowing for some local autonomy, then essentially, like going back to your sort of checks and balances terminology, I guess the negative feedback there is kind of ensuring that things don't spiral out of control, and it's kind of pulling the organization back to the norm. And also, ideally, you want to allow positive feedback to allow those sort of breakthroughs and innovation and reinforcing success without getting kind of caught in a bubble and overreaching. That's a sort of a well-balanced organization in terms of a balance of authority that we've been talking about, and sort of managing that tension and as you say, checks and balances and feedback loops.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, it comes back again to what I mentioned briefly earlier, when we put our systems hat on, is the sort of principles of cybernetics. And that really is exactly as you say, it's about kind of push-pull. It's about kind of positive and negative feedback loops. And in cybernetics, negative feedback loops effectively dampen deviations from a set goal. So those negative feedback loops they promote stability effectively. They kind of prevent people straying too far from the path. For organizations, these are typically found in the sort of the checks and balances, the rules, the policies, the oversight mechanisms, the things that the guardrails, I guess, that the organization puts in place to ensure that every team member operates within the sort of established guidelines. So they are your sort of, they're your sort of your guardrails. But then we've also got those kind of positive feedback loops. So the things that drive innovation, that drive kind of rapid expansion, that ultimately, if managed in the right way, create a lot of positive behaviors, the things that actually do take you perhaps a little further off the path than you wanted, because there is actually, there is another path leading off in a slightly different direction. And actually sometimes the right thing to do is to follow that. And in organizations where, the guardrails are up like the sort of bowling lane for the kids, and you just can't, you can't go off the path, you never have the opportunity to chase an idea, to sort of follow a dream. And that's massively problematic, I think, in organizational health. And not just in terms of missed opportunities, but actually from a sort of culture and human perspective, human beings need a degree of autonomy to be happy. It's not something we probably talk about that much. Maybe it's something we should talk about more on the pod. But, we talk about systems in quite a technical way, even when we're talking about human systems. But, people want to feel heard. They want to have their ideas put onto the table. They want to ultimately contribute and innovate and do those things that human beings are really, really great at. And I think that's, that's increasingly an important conversation in the sort of world of AI that we live in now. And actually those positive feedback loops of going back to a sort of a technical technical view, they are the ones that often take you to great places, but also they, you know, unchecked and unrestrained, they can also, you know, they can also crash the car, and they lead you to do silly things, perhaps. You know, I think the came back to that what was it called when we had that sort of when systems go wrong episode, the Cisco flip camera thing.
Oh, the was it the Fuse, the camera thing? It looks like a smartphone, but it's just a camera.
But isn't, yeah. And they spent, you know, $1 billion on or whatever. But yeah, so that's what happens. We get an unchecked positive feedback loop, and you don't have the right guardrails in place. But equally, you know, to perhaps stay on the theme of consumer electronics, when you properly balance authority, when you properly balance positive and negative feedback loops, then you encourage innovation, you encourage distributed authority, and you get all the benefit of that while still staying on the path. And I think Apple are historically a fantastic example of you know, letting innovation lead an organization in a positive way, because they had enough deep structure, they had enough guardrails to know what was positive innovation and what wasn't, or what was aligned innovation to their sort of purpose and to their ICP, but equally to be non-specific about how that might manifest itself. And that's how you get category creation, like, you know, like the iPad, like the tablet device.
Yeah. So, by the way, it was the Cisco, it was Flip. I think they bought the company Flip.
I thought I said Flip.
I think you said it, and I, for some reason, thought it was Fuse or something, which absolutely wasn't. So I just thought I would do a correction before I have to come back and like publish a correction later. So I guess just to conclude that sort of cybernetic section, it's this tension between the negative and positive feedback loops that kind of keeps the organization on the sort of, maybe not the straight path, but on a sort of middle path. It's like they act as sort of checks and balances on each other. I think something that we've spoken about in various ways across this series particularly, and we've mentioned it earlier, and I think we should turn to now, is around that sort of shadow authority and informal networks and where the leader has blind spots. You alluded to it with a particularly sort of autocratic organization earlier. And of course, this kind of muddies the waters of things like feedback loops, doesn't it? Because clearly the reason that the pragmatic reasons generally that shadow structures exist kind of preclude total transparency, don't they?
Absolutely. Now, I'm fully expecting, and maybe we should lead with it, an anecdote about, you know, officers and enlisted men in the army and where decisions actually get made here.
Well, I guess that's one area where shadow structures can be particularly problematic, particularly if there are sort of multiple organizations working together, like multiple militaries who are not necessarily fully interoperable. That could be a problem. I won't go with a big long anecdote about what happened in some war where shadow authority caused a problem.
But yeah, I think it's such an interesting. It's such an interesting field or kind of thing to think about, is how decisions actually get made. You know, who has the real knowledge in the organization, and who, and where does the balance of power actually sit? And, you know, I think that the military example is an interesting one, because what you'll get certainly in the British Army, I don't know for our American listeners and further afield whether it's the same, but officers are typically university graduates. They will, you know, get an education, then they will go directly into an officer training college, and they will then come out and they will lead a company of soldiers, and they're effectively, you know, fresh out of school into this management position. You know, they are like, you know, your sort of archetypal McKinsey, you know, fresh out of the Ivy Leagues kind of management consultant. They know a lot of stuff, but they don't have any experience. And they'll often have, you know, a soldier reporting into them who might have 30 years of experience and, you know, have done many campaigns. And this is like, you know, this is an interesting kind of reality of shadow power, you know, shadow authority, because, you know, a smart officer will listen to the bloke that's got 30 years experience and use that to really use as a significant steer in their decision making. You know, one that is perhaps less adept might think that they know it all and have problems. But if you were to ask, you know, higher up the chain of command who had the authority, well, it would be the officer.
Clearly, but I think we could probably pull a whole series of anecdotes about experienced platoon sergeants and how they've had to effectively just sort of shadow manage a whip behind the ears second lieutenant again and again and again and again.
Exactly.
And that's just kind of part of the job, right?
And I think in a slightly different way, I think that does happen in organizations. You know, when you've got the subject matter expert in a growth team who is the, you know, who is the expert on your, I don't know, whatever, paid media strategy, on your, you know, whatever, it doesn't matter. But, you know, you've got someone that's got the knowledge and they are the SME and they really, really know their stuff. If you're making a decision about something, you know, the CMO will have the final say when it comes to things like budgetary distribution. But ultimately, if you're making a strategic decision, it will come from the SME. And therefore, that's, you know, that's where the true balance of power is in a certain scenario, in a certain situation. And, you know, that's just looking at non-relationship factors. When you start putting relationship factors in, like actually, you know, when it's going back to school, you know, who's the popular kid? Well, you know, they have no more authority than the rest of the people in school, but because they're the, you know, they're the popular one, they get to make all the decisions about who we're doing and what we're doing and who's in and who's out. And it still happens in organizations. You know, it's a facet of human nature. If you've got that big character, the outspoken, shouty one in your team, then they probably get their way quite a lot. You know, he what's the phrase? Yeah, he who shouts loudest, you know, I can't think of what the phrase is, but ultimately this is all happening. You know, these kind of human conditions within the team, the sort of human behavioral dynamics shape authority. You know, someone who's just joined the org, and I suppose it's about character as well. You know, I think we've probably all at some point had a manager who we would have described as being a bit weak, maybe overpromoted, maybe not really having the ear of the people above them, or indeed the respect or enough respect of the people that are supposed to be reporting into them. And then you get an element of just people doing what they like and it being unchecked and things getting out of alignment. So I guess coming right back to the top of the episode and what you said is authority is not just about org charts. And I think that this sort of concept of shadow authority is really talking about the true on the ground human experience of how decisions actually get made, not how they should get made.
So I guess kind of moving away from the org chart, but in effect using something similar, we need to sort of encourage like really systematic mapping of the real sort of alliances and lines of trust and potential friction points in the organization, not just what's on the org chart.
Like yes.
the unofficial org chart that sits under the org chart, I guess.
Yeah, absolutely. I think it is. It's interesting, wasn't it? Because when we sell things, if you use a we have the concept decision makers and influence, don't we? That's a really common thing that gets talked about. You know, is this person an influencer or are they a decision maker? Are they the budget holder? Or are they a champion, depending on whether you're using a med pick or whatever? But actually this concept of influence in control, you know, that is true in every organization. You know, and that influence manifests itself in different ways. And I think mapping influence as well as technical authority is an interesting thing. How you do that in a structured way, I'm afraid I don't have a good answer to, but certainly it's something to be deeply aware of, and where the balance of power is in the organization, not just who is notionally the budget holder.
It's something like you'd kind of made a half joke about me using an example from the military earlier, but what this actually, this talk about shadow authority actually reminds me of, don't worry, I won't go off on a big spiel about it, is, as you know, I studied the sort of medieval period a lot, where it's particularly in early times, there are really no formal, there's no org chart for the medieval period, particularly early on. And so everything is about shadow authority structures or informal authority structures. And actually, the part of the historian's job here is this systematic mapping of alliances and trust lines and friction points. And there's this interesting interplay of the personal and the public, I guess you could say. So something I have some experience of trying to do, and it's really hard to do. But at the same time, it gives you a much truer picture of reality than, like you say, an org chart.
I suppose for us less learned on history than you, then I suppose you can probably see that, maybe you disagree, by watching something like Game of Thrones. You know, you can kind of get that of the, you know, you might have a strong king, you might have a weak king, where are the decisions actually getting made? You know, is it the king's hand or, you know, the...
Well, what you see in that is, because so one thing that annoys medievalists about Game of Thrones, for example, is that the power structures are too formalized and too rigid. But actually, where it kind of pulls it back is that it starts to, when it starts to fall apart, like the personal authority of the king at the top starts to break down, and there starts to be, like, you know, competition over who is the real authority. And then you see the informal structures start to come to the fore, which is more accurately medieval sort of thing. Not that it specifically claims to be medieval, but it basically does, doesn't it? Pulling us back from a discussion about Game of Thrones, because it is, we are recording this on a Friday, and I would quite like to just get into that discussion, really. Pulling us back to something that we talked about in this series, we talked about building sort of cross-functional teams, mission-based squads, and kind of sort of fluid reallocation of resources, I guess. And obviously authority is part of that, like that fluid reallocation of decision-making power. Now, in the context of discussing authority in the growth team operating system, that's obviously really relevant to have a discussion about how we manage that, because clearly mission-based squads are not something that appears on the standard org chart.
No, such a good question. So how do we manage mission-based squads? I mean, I guess as a starting point, authority on the org chart is never less relevant, you know, than when you're looking at a mission-based team. And I think that obviously we're advocates for cross-functional teaming, and ultimately, I think that's a reality of how real organizations actually work. And therefore, you absolutely can't just rely, or perhaps you... I've certainly had personal experience of being in mission-based teams that actually are hugely ineffective because they haven't got this governance and control piece right. And they become, sort of mini sort of councils, you know, they become committees. They have people with different factions and different needs and requirements that they are trying to then go and get for their, you know, for their constituency, for their team. And they're obviously horribly ineffective because you don't have this clear authority structure that's built into the, the composition of the mission-based team. And I guess the question is, of course, well, how do you do that? Well, obviously you can't rely on the org chart because you might have, you know, multiple people of the same level in there. You might have, if you maybe in a cross-market team, you know, going back to my car industry example, if you had a launch team for a product and you were collaborating across, you know, all of the European markets, well, you know, you'd have 10 people on a mission-based team that had the same job title. So how do you manage that? You know, who wins? Well, I guess that's a problem, isn't it? You have this, or you introduce this concept of kind of the self and the home market. So what the best practice is, to my mind, really, is baking in those control structures at a mission-based level, almost seeing it as a mini org in itself. And I think it's really therefore about building in levels of discretion and also purpose. So, you know, if a mission-based team is there to solve a problem, what is the problem they're trying to solve? And I think if that problem is not well-defined in the first place, then you've got a lot of issues in terms of how you then even manage authority, because it's not clear what, you know, what the authority is there to achieve. So, you know, if you were in that sort of, we seem to be all about the car industry today, you know, if you were trying to launch a car, well, actually, what is the point of the mission-based team? Is it just to launch the car? Well, if it is, then that's going to be a mess, isn't it? Because everyone's going to have their own local market requirements. They're all going to have their own language requirements, their own consumer behaviors, their own kind of brand perceptions. And if you're trying to unify what you're doing, that is not the right, you've not asked the right question in the first place. If what you're trying to do by bringing all those people together is, you know, bring forward an appropriate level of kind of consistency in how something is done, of resource sharing, whatever it might be, then okay, your purpose is then probably more clearly defined. So how are we going to split up the budget, maybe, or whatever the question might be? And with that, I think it's about then putting in what you might call kind of zones of authority. So the mission-based team can, you know, they have a budget threshold that they can allocate, and they've got this sort of local autonomy and they've got this speed of action. They can make decisions really quickly without needing to go back into the center for mediation. But you kind of bake in at the start what you might call a sort of escalation threshold. So, you know, when something hits a certain point, then, you know, you've hit the threshold where you've got to seek higher authorization. You know, you've got to go back into the center for authority. And if you clarify the threshold, and you clarify the sort of path of escalation, if you like. So in this mission-based team, you know, the executive sponsor is this individual. And therefore, the path of escalation, once you hit the threshold, is to go to that individual. You know, you've kind of defined at the start the pathway for issue management, and you've defined at the start the threshold at which you know, you need to go and escalate something. So you're kind of building in the sort of escalation trigger points, if you like. So I don't know. Be like a cost overrun, or is there a brand impact beyond the team, or is there a regulatory risk, or is there, I don't know, whatever it's not. But the point is, if you're starting to map those trigger points at the start, map those thresholds, map the pathway, then at that point, you know, you've made it disambiguous. You know, you've effectively removed the sort of second guessing. You've removed the potential for sort of politicking and kind of people following their own agendas. And I guess in addition to that, you can also use. I'd like to actually do a episode just on stuff like RACI and decision making frameworks, because I don't really like them that much, but the principle of them, I think, is a really, really good idea. So, you know, if you have put in place a sort of, a RACI style chart, so for those who don't know what RACI is, you know, you've defined at an individual level who's responsible, who's accountable, who's consulted, and who's informed. You know, if you've done that for your mission-based team, and you then use that RACI framework to also define the thresholds and the escalation, then you're baking that into the documentation of the team at the start. So I think that's quite a good principle to use. Now, the problem I actually have with stuff like RACI is, like, you know, what does accountable mean? You know, does it mean that actually, if it all goes horribly wrong, you're the person we point the finger at and blame? You know, is that what accountable means? Or does it actually mean that you're the one that does all the work? I mean, so, you know.
Or just the one who reports on it, maybe,
exactly.
And has to own up when it goes wrong.
Exactly. And, you know, consulted, what does consulted mean? Does consulted mean you've got veto power, or we'll just take your opinion into account and put it into the melting pot? So I think there's a lot of problems with RACI that's when it's poorly defined, and it almost always is poorly defined what those things mean. People get very consumed in the exercise of putting names in boxes without actually really thinking about what the purpose of that and what the actual expectation is of the individual within that box, and what we really want them to do. But the principle of creating a framework at the start where you define how control is distributed and how decisions get made, and what those kind of thresholds and pathways are where stuff trips out of the mission-based team and into the larger org, ultimately add structure is probably the way I could have condensed the last, you know, however long I've been talking.
I think we probably, I think decision-making frameworks is a subject, not that I'm saying we shouldn't have covered it to the level that we did, but I think it's definitely got potential as an episode in its own right. What about just kind of zooming out a bit to how we think about authority within, because I feel like if we get into RACI and decision making frameworks, we're kind of potentially getting down in the weeds and forgetting that we're talking, maybe not forgetting, but kind of diverting attention from the fact that we're talking about authority as part of the growth team operating system. Like, it's not an isolated dimension. It's no. Like a tension field bridging the sort of deep structural sort of identity, the organization, purpose and values and all that stuff we covered at the start of the series with actually those real mechanics of execution, which again, we've been covering more recently, workflows, measurables, etc. So leaders are obviously having to orchestrate authority structures so they don't really sabotage that operating system synergy, if you like, or are attempting to create that synergy of the GTOS of the growth team operating system. They essentially need to manage that tension field. That's part of what we mean by authority here, right?
Yes. Yeah, exactly that. And, you know, authority clearly isn't, I mean, none of the dimensions in the operating system are isolated, but it is, it is definitely a significant point of tension, because if you don't get the authority piece right, then a lot of the other stuff doesn't work at all, because authority and the ability to execute are obviously intrinsically linked in the majority of organizations anyway. So really, we're talking about the real mechanics of execution. And I think that when you come to things like workflows that we talked about last week, you know, workflows are really all about authority and decision-making. You know, how does something get from one end to the other? And there's always going to be a lot of kind of authority-based pathways in there. And ultimately, what we've got to do is make sure, as with everything else in the growth team operating system, in operating systems in general, that we've got to kind of orchestrate the relationship between all of the dimensions. And ultimately, from authority, you know, we've got to orchestrate the authority structures so that they don't sabotage the ability for things to work. So purpose kind of is an interesting one, because obviously it's the starting point of everything. It's the first dimension. It's the guidance point of the system. It's the sort of the goals, if you like, that we are striving for. Well, you know, if the system purpose is to be the most innovative, I don't know, whatever product in the category, but actually every time we want to innovate, for which we, you know, do something that isn't on the plan, you need, you know, 10 levels of sign off, then you're going to kill innovation. You know, people won't bother. It will be too difficult. And ultimately, it's also probably seen that purpose is not true. You know, you're not walking the talk. So it becomes a nonsense, and you're going to get disengagement, and you're not going to drive innovation. So you know, if you get that sort of authority is contrary to purpose, then actually really it isn't your purpose at all. You know, purpose is emergent, as we've talked about before, and you know, authority could be a way that actually you are, you know, it could be a key inflection point where you're moving away from what you think your intended purpose is. Same thing with measurables, really. You know, if you're pushing from the top down what all those metrics need to be, you know, then the likelihood is you're going to be chasing some of the wrong metrics. Those metrics aren't going to be well aligned. You know, you're going to have some goal conflict in there. And if people don't have the ability to kind of change the framework of measurement to have those strong feedback loops, and then ultimately you're going to go off the path. You're baking in misalignment, as we've talked about. Yeah, you could probably talk about stuff like incentives as well. You know, incentives, you know, people do what they're measured on. You know, if you're incentivizing the wrong stuff, then ultimately it doesn't matter how much authority to make decisions about what the organization or the sub team or the subsystem does. If you're incentivizing things that are different to what the, you know, that you've got delegated authority, then great. Well, everyone's got this lovely delegated authority. They can make all the decisions they need to make. But if you haven't changed the framework of incentives and therefore the framework of kind of targets and measurement, then the authority to do different things and to innovate is pointless, because people just do the things they're measured and paid on. So you kind of see there's lots of points of intersection where you really, really need to do the alignment check. You know, does one thing promote the other thing? You know, where is the conflict in the sort of systematic cohesion of the operating system?
Yeah, I'm surprised that that's the first time we started talking about alignment and misalignment, which might be a record for a growth system episode.
I think, I think it probably is. Yeah, we're 45 plus minutes in, and that's the first time alignment. Christ.
I think that's a first for us. So I think one last area that I would like to cover, because I know we need to wrap up today, we kind of touched on it with our sort of playful example about sort of Game of Thrones, how authority evolves during crises or major transitions, and how to sort of anticipate and I guess mitigate against those sort of shifts. Like, we see these big pivots like acquisitions or a new leader or a major account that an organization's over reliant on collapses. And we often see that as a catalyst for sort of radical authority shifts. So how do we prepare so that these aren't just like panic reorgs, but actually, you know, a catalyst for a sort of positive guided transformation?
That's a big question to end on.
I was going to say it's a bit of a big question, maybe not too fair, but if we could touch on that before closing off, that'd be great.
So system shocks are inevitable. And for me, one of the central tenets of kind of systems thinking is actually scenario planning. We've touched on system dynamics and system modeling, I think probably in the first season. And modeling is really inherently about scenario planning. And what I really, really like is not just to come up with a huge causal loop diagram with many data scenarios in it, as fun as that might be, I'm sure you'll agree, is actually just to bring that into the real world. So, you know, some people call it wargaming, some people call it red teaming, but ultimately to sort of periodically think about worst case scenarios, to think about system shocks, to think about, you know, what that would mean. And okay, you probably can't do that for an acquisition, but certainly for something like a big account leaving the business, you know, what would you do? And you can use that exercise to identify gaps in processes, to identify gaps in communication or indeed authority. And really, when you do an exercise like that, you can start to understand what control structures are required, and ultimately to sort of pre-approve contingencies. So if you've got a, you know, if you've got a what-if plan, then you know within that contingency plan who'd step into the vacuum effectively left by the by the account loss or by the whatever shock that had happened, how you'd reallocate the budgets, how you'd reshuffle responsibility, dare I say who'd have to leave the organization as an as a sort of budgetary imperative. And I think that if you know, much like when we were talking about mission-based teams, what the threshold is, what the what the trigger is, and then when you cross that threshold, then you trigger the contingency plan. And I think that that sort of red teaming exercise can come from that. And yes, if you do want to build that into a giant CLD model, then also you can really robustly.
You're just itching to do it, aren't you?
I quite enjoy doing. Sorry, planning is CLD. It's my sort of personal hobby. I mean, no, it's not really, but it is interesting. You can build. The people have this concept in scenario planning of like building a digital twin of your organization. So you can actually say, okay, well, what happened if suddenly, our 100 million of revenue turned into 50 million because we, someone imposed 20% tariffs, for instance, sort of unilaterally across the world.
Something wild and unlikely like that.
Something unlikely like that, yeah. What would happen if suddenly, one of the biggest exporters got 45% tariffs and, another country got zero and they were both global superpowers. What would happen then? So you can do those kind of scenario plans through the mechanism of saying, okay, well, actually, if the revenue fell to X, then what else happens? Obviously, the rest of the organization doesn't work. What do you need to do? What levers do you need to pull? Why is the contingency plan for certain thresholds? I was thinking that conversation about kind of mission-based teams is actually brings up quite an interesting point in my head, at least, about how you manage that kind of disaster planning, which is actually if you've built the sort of muscle of working in mission-based teams, of working cross-functionally, of ultimately being used to working in semi-autonomous teams, working in ways where authority is delegated and rearranged in ways that are perhaps contrary or parallel to the org chart, then you actually train the team to work like that. And then suddenly you have a shock and everyone gets smashed together in a different way. It doesn't take them 6 months to get up to speed again because they're used to it. So I think, again, it's a form of, scenario planning, and that's almost a form of training, like create an agile organization, get people used to working in different authority structures, because then actually a transition to doing that when required is going to be quite smooth.
Especially if tying back to the other elements, the other dimensions, if everyone's pulling towards the same North Star, then that's extremely helpful when going through a kind of fairly sudden reorganization, right?
Yeah, 100%. And I think it's by doing those exercises, ultimately also you spot the signals early and you can then action the plan, and people are then adept at then executing on the plan. So you build resilience into the organization, dare I use the word anti-fragility again, but you get an org that is stronger and more resilient because you are, training people to deal with organizational shift and structural shift. And I suspect, although I have no evidence to sort of corroborate this, but I suspect the more you do stuff like that, the less entrenched the people in your organization become, and actually probably to some degree the less bored. And the less entrenched in their ways and their opinions, and I think actually you then probably foster agile mindsets, but also you probably get a degree of human self-selection in terms of who chooses to be part of a team like that. So I think if that's how you want to run your org, I think that you need to kind of walk it, not plan it.
You need to walk it, not plan it. I like that. That was a nice soundbite that we could sum up. So I guess, unfortunately, I think we're about to run out of time. I was just sort of thinking of ways to sum up what's quite a rich topic. I mean, authority, which is something that I guess tends to be thought of as kind of a rigid set of structures and interconnections, actually its best shape might be described as something that's ephemeral and dynamic, and what's perfect sort of in one market or one stage might be suboptimal in another, or just as time progresses or as external factors shift. And I guess a lot of what we're talking about here, particularly in that last section, it is sort of building in that capability to be able to quickly pivot and realign if necessary, or to enable that sort of dynamism and that move away from sort of rigid but brittle structures.
Yeah, 100% that. I mean, we've talked quite a lot over time. I know I'm not supposed to introduce a new idea at the wrap up, but you know, we talked quite a lot of time about like self-organization in teams, and actually that really that authority dimension has a huge component in terms of the link to structure from that episode and people. You know, if we are prioritizing self-organization ultimately, then we need to kind of make sure that we've got the right degree of delegated authority, of the right degree of, you know, freedom to make decisions and control that has been passed into teams so that we can promote innovation. And ultimately, you know, to sum this episode up, I guess, is to, if you recognize that authority is non-rigid, you know, it is not based on, the reality of authority is not based on what it says in your org chart. It is a dynamic thing within the organization and needs to be treated as such. Then ultimately what you need to do when you're designing for authority is understand what your purpose is always. And actually, if your purpose is to make an organization that is agile, you know, to make an organization that is not brittle, that is, you know, anti-fragile, that is able to respond to market shifts, positive and negative, then you need to strike that balance of governance and, you know, sort of delegated authority. So, you know, decentralizing power completely is not a good idea. Centralizing power is not a good idea. So how do you strike the balance in the middle? And, you know, I think the conversation we were just having about, you know, mission-based teams and building the muscle and scenario planning, and actually all of that, I think, is a mindset thing. I think if you can build a mindset of having an agile mindset in terms of how you make decisions within an organization and therefore how you delegate authority, then actually what you are building is a resilient organization that's adaptable and able to, you know, quickly harness opportunities and respond to, downturns, or I can't think of a good word for bad stuff.
Effectively, what could otherwise be a catastrophe becomes an opportunity if you've done this right, I suppose, to sort of strengthen the organization. Well, once again, we've probably uncovered about 3 or 4 topics that we can do whole episodes on, and we're not going to have time to go into them, but it was very interesting as always, and managed to keep me away from some of my more indulgent anecdotes. Thanks for that.
If that's the first longest military anecdote, wasn't you?
I like that actually.
Watershed moment when we didn't talk about with alignment until 45 minutes in.
We're growing as people, Chris. But we really are about to run out of time, guys. So all that's left to say really is just please don't forget to follow and rate the podcast. It really helps us to bring the content to a wider audience, which is already sort of surprisingly wide in a geographical sense, and growing in terms of the absolute numbers as well. We'd also really appreciate if you could take a moment of your time just to give us some feedback. Tell us what you think. It actually does sort of influence how we create the show. The Growth System is brought to you by us. We're RevSpace. We're a growth systems consultancy. Connect B2B organizations with the future of growth. And we offer consultancy, education, and applied delivery services. That really is it for this week, folks. So thanks very much for listening. If you listened this far, we'll catch you next week. Bye-bye.
Thank you.